Welcome to the It's Going Down podcast, a weekly search for new forms of life in the midst of a civilization in collapse. In this episode, we speak with a member of the Black Rose Anarchist Federation, Arthur Pye, about the increasing threat of climate change, growing state repression against protest, new activist formations such as Extinction Rebellion, and legislative proposals such as the Green New Deal. But is there hope in the state being able to legislate away the climate crisis? Or should humanity instead look towards building a material force through social movements as a means of ensuring survival in the coming decades? It's Going Down is part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network and plays on 94.1 KPFA out of Berkeley, California. Thank you for listening. Let's get into it. Till we bring the whole city down. Party ain't over until we bring the whole system down.
My name is Arthur Pye. I'm a member of Black Rose Anarchist Federation, Rosa Negra, and I'm based here in what we call the Salish Sea here in the Pacific Northwest. It's Coast Salish territory. In recent years, I've been mostly involved with sort of local and regional struggles against fossil fuel expansion. So sort of that looks like community struggles against pipeline fights, expansion of oil train terminals, export terminals, refineries, tanker traffic over the water, and things like that. I mean, a lot of people think about the Pacific Northwest, I think, as some sort of idyllic, I don't know, yuppie environmental utopia. And big surprise, it's not. For the fossil fuel industry, it's actually a major hub which plays a critical role in the transportation of fossil fuels from places like the Alberta tar sands and the Bakken shale formation, and coal all over the place and frack gas all over the place. To actually get those products to market, they have to go through this region. So we have just a constant slew of proposals for expanding current export terminals, building new infrastructure. And at the same time, every step of the way, there's been a really consistent and frankly, like fairly successful community resistance to these projects, often led by indigenous communities. Here we have tribes in almost all of the communities that face local fossil fuel infrastructure projects. And that's looked like a lot of different things. You know, we've had a lot of fights that have actually involved coalitions, broad-based coalitions, which have involved like everything from small, radical, direct action-oriented affinity groups to like large NGOs and everything in between. And like I said, for the most part, there's been a lot of success in fighting these projects. So I would just say like the most recent fight is against something called the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion. That's a tar sands pipeline that threatens to triple the capacity of an existing pipeline by building a whole new tar sands pipeline from Alberta to Vancouver, British Columbia, which would send like a 700% increase in tanker traffic through the whole region, including down in Washington State in the U.S. And there's been all kinds of really inspiring indigenous-led resistance and grassroots resistance, from like occupations and land defense to like blockades of oil shipments and oil barges and everything in between. So
awesome.
I've been involved in all kinds of stuff like that, allegedly.
It seems like every week there's a new climate report out about how bad things are. Just based on your own analysis, where are we at? How bad is it?
Well, based on my professional opinion, I would say that bad. I mean, obviously, it's not about my opinion, right? It's like the science is pretty clear. I don't claim any kind of expertise beyond the latest science that I read. And my understanding is just what you described. You know, I think it's definitely an actual crisis. I think Bill Nye the Science Guy recently went on the John Oliver show, and even he put it by saying the planet is on
fire.
Yeah, exactly. You saw that. So I don't think I can say it any better than that. It's true that there's all kinds of sort of parallel processes going on with climate change and sort of consequences of climate change. Ocean acidification is a huge one. And then just the symptoms of climate change, right? Like we, in this region, we face terrible wildfires that seem to be getting, worse and worse every single season.
Right.
And that's just kind of a part of the new normal, but I do think it's important to keep in mind that it's easy to get disillusioned when you read the science. And to be honest, sometimes I just have to kind of set it aside and just keep plugging it away at what I think is good organizing, because it can be overwhelming and sort of disheartening. But, you know, it's not really a win or lose kind of fight. Everything that we do, matters, I think, you know, and the more effective we are, the more powerful movements we can build, you know, the more we're going to be able to slow these processes, deal, you know, build community resilience to deal with the effects of climate chaos, and to also prevent some sort of, you know, political regression into, you know, eco-fascism by really building a kind of counterpart power of popular power to fight those kinds of trends. So it looks bad, but there are things that we can do.
Just based on your own predictions, where do you think we'll be at in 50 years? You know, what do young people have to look forward to, in other words?
I mean, well, again, yeah, in my professional opinion, I'm just reading the latest science. It doesn't look good. I think the latest studies show that if current trends continue unchanged, then by mid-century, or at the very least by the end of the century, we're looking at something like 4 to 6 feet of sea level rise. You know, that paired with something like 10 billion people on the planet would just decimate coastal cities. I mean, that means Miami's gone and everything like it is gone. We're looking at things like 100-year storms happening every single year in a predictable way. That's not a pretty picture, and that's just scratching the surface, right? That's not including, you know, if we get to something like 8 degrees of warming, it doesn't look good. It's something like game over. You know, we would have things like methane bubbling in the world's oceans and people suffocating on it and, losing most of, you know, arable land and clean drinking water due to sea level rise, contaminating clean water. Okay. So that's not a rosy picture, but again, that's if we don't do anything, right? So that doesn't mean that that's what's going to happen. That's just kind of a warning of what could happen. But, you know, in a sober analysis, we haven't drastically changed our current trends yet, right? So I would say on the other side of things, my best understanding of like what safe looks like is really no more than like 1 degree warming and 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. We're already past that. We're kind of, I think, teetering not far from 1 degree. Realistic best case, maybe something like 2 degrees. I hate to say that. But that would still involve like significant sea level rise, maybe something like 3 feet, which would still devastate a whole lot of coastal cities, mass displacement of people. And so that means, like, best case scenario, we're still going to have to deal with massive resettlement from the coasts. And that gets back to this question, right, of, like, the degree to which we can organize powerful movements is going to be the degree to which we can actually affect people's lives and you know, win concessions from the powers that be to make sure that people that are displaced, you know, have the resources to live healthy, dignified lives. And that's at a bare minimum, right? But I mean, essentially what UN is saying, the most conservative estimates, I think, is that, you know, by something like 2030, we have to essentially cut emissions in half. And that's just a massive undertaking, which is going to take nothing short of large-scale global revolt powerful enough to, like, literally threaten the stability of existing power structures.
What do people need to know in terms of the relationship between the fossil fuel industry and the Trump administration?
Yeah, I mean, it's scary stuff, right? Like, it's sort of, I feel like it's almost in vogue, especially on the left, especially kind of the anarchist left, to kind of gloss over differences between administrations, right? Especially like between the Republican and Democratic parties. And it's definitely true, right? That like the root cause of these problems, of this crisis, goes way deeper than the differences, any of the sort of, you know, small differences between the Republican and Democratic parties, or one president versus another. But, and it's a big but, I think, and it might be a hard truth to swallow. I think there are really important differences, and, you know, even small differences in an institution like the United States government, which is maybe the most powerful institution in the world, right? It's the head of a global empire. Those small differences have really significant effects on people's lives and on, you know, global trends. So I frankly think that this shift from, say, just from the Obama administration to the Trump administration has actually been a sort of qualitative shift, in the sort of position and footing of our movement. I would say from something like an offensive footing to a defensive footing. And it's not that the Democratic Party isn't partially responsible, right, for like these differences and these regressions. But the truth is nonetheless that, like, you know, just to take a concrete example, the Dakota Access Pipeline was stopped under the Obama administration through mass action, right? It was just reversed under the new administration. Plain as that. I mean, some of that is the fact that, the movement kind of got a late start, right? You know, when we find ourselves in a position where we're sort of building the kind of power that's necessary in a moment that's a little bit too late and things are already getting built, an example of Standing Rock, then that's a tough position to be in. And it makes you more vulnerable for something like a Trump, you know, to come in and change things. But those are important differences, right? Like, it's not a matter of sort of saying, okay, well, then what we need is Democrats in power. The point is to understand the differences, however subtle, right, as just part of the calculus of movement strategy. So we understand right. what we're up against, how we need to fight differently when our enemies change. So Standing Rock is a good example, but obviously, like, I thought the most blatant example of what Trump represented for environmental policy, right, was his decision to appoint Rex Tillerson to Secretary right. of State. I mean, if you had to sort of personify all that is wrong with this world as far as, like, the climate crisis, you would pick somebody like Rex Tillerson, and he just put him ahead of, like, all of national and international diplomacy. So that's not insignificant, right? And under Scott Pruitt, the EPA has sort of made really like a fundamental shift from, however limited it was, from at least like an agency whose purpose was some sort of regulation to literally a deregulation agency, like not even functioning in the same way initially.
I was just hearing on the radio that, you know, the EPA now is trying to loosen standards to allow like more facing more air pollution to be like the accepted limit.
Exactly.
It's like this.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's literally, I think what it comes down to is changes in the way that deaths are counted as directly related to particulate matter pollution. So like there's a pretty straightforward, like, it's a math problem, right? When they gut the Clean Air Act, again, however limited that was under the Obama administration, there's a finite number, there's a specific number of deaths that are sort of predictable as a result. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's hard because it's so depressing. It's almost hard not to laugh at because you kind of, I need my coping mechanisms, you know, but it's a pretty dark humor. So, and this pulling out of the Paris Agreement, you know, we haven't even mentioned, right? Like,
right.
That as limited as that was, a non-binding agreement, it was still, I don't know. It was inching towards at least some sort of progress, and it's just a big middle finger to any kind of national commitment to reduce. So there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, in some ways, the true effects haven't all been felt yet. You know, so we have things like efforts to open up offshore drilling, Arctic drilling, both in the National Wildlife Refuge as well as in the Arctic Ocean. You know, trying to bring back coal, which is almost largely symbolic. EPA deregulation, public lands getting sold off to be used for fossil fuel extraction. A lot of these things have kind of been tied up in like state and local and regional court systems, but they're real threats. And we're going to, even with a fundamentally different kind of administration in the future, we're still going to have to fight to inch our way back to square one, which was not a pretty picture to begin with.
You brought up Rex Tillerson, who used to have a position in the Trump administration and was famously the former CEO of Exxon, who, interestingly, in the 1970s, they were producing research that talked about the realities of climate change and talked about how bad things were getting. And I think this really begs the question is, do the elites as a class like have a strategy? I mean, they know this is happening. I mean, despite whatever they might put out in the media of, climate denial or whatever. But, I mean, sometimes they talk about going to Mars. Is that the extent of it? Or, these kind of like, doomsday bunkers for the 1% we might see on Vice or something like that. Is that basically the extent of how they are preparing?
You could say, yeah. I mean, their answer is basically, let's keep getting rich and watch the world burn. I think this is almost the greatest example that history has set up for us of the just purely pathological nature of capitalism, right?
But I mean, they have to know, like, these companies, these dynasties, these brands that you're creating, like, they might not be around in 50 years.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't matter, right? I mean, corporations are set up to make profit today, right? Like, maybe, next quarter. But, I mean, they will do and have proven time and time again, they will do whatever they need to do or not do to stay in power and safeguard short-term profitability, even at the expense of their own short-term interests, right? So, you're right, 100%. There's a real contradiction there and a sort of pathological, self-defeating nature to it. But again, it's all about making profits today. You know, capitalism doesn't run off of long-term planning. It runs off of profitability today and infinite growth with finite resources. And so you just keep churning up until the whole thing blows up. I mean, corporate elites, if they do have any plan at all, it's things like market solutions, right? Which, of course, are really false solutions. It's the idea that somehow capitalism could take care of itself and the market could sort of take self-correcting measures if we could only incentivize reductions in emissions. So that's where you get things like cap and trade, things like carbon credits, right? Which are essentially about literally commodifying not only natural resources, but commodifying pollution itself. So a corporation can have the right to pollute. So these are the kinds of solutions that, you see peddled at like the UN climate conferences and things like this. So say, if you own and operate a refinery in the United States, say that's worth X amount of carbon credits. With this idea, say you could buy up, a forest in Brazil of however many thousands of acres. And by owning that forest and essentially displacing the indigenous population and preventing them from harvesting timber and food and other resources, you are preventing, those trees from being cut and those emissions from being released in the atmosphere. Therefore, you can just go on extracting oil, refining it, burning it, polluting all you want. You can keep doing exactly what you're doing and get rich while you're doing it, as long as you've sort of done this clever accounting. But obviously it's beyond a false solution. It's sort of sold as some sort of clever accounting, but it's really just a loophole for them to keep getting rich while watching the world burn.
Speaking of failures, what is the history of global agreements to curb climate change or even just legislation within the United States specifically?
it's kind of a sad history. I suppose it shouldn't be super surprising. I mean, first of all, like this idea that emitting carbon and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is going to destabilize the climate is not a very new idea. I think, like, conceptually, there are people that understood this well, like, even in the late 19th century, literally. I think people started really recording emissions and testing this kind of theory, like, in the 50s and 60s. And then, like you mentioned, when it gets to the 70s and 80s, ironically, ExxonMobil and other oil companies that followed suit, they started putting, you know, their own scientists to work on studying this. They kind of got a whiff of what might be possible, and they thought, well, we should sort of get ahead of the curve on this and figure out what's actually going on. And they realized, indeed, you know, human emissions were destabilizing the global climate. And they even came to the conclusion that by the time we start feeling the effects, it will already be too late, probably. But, you know, instead of sounding the alarm, they decided to more or less keep it to themselves. By the time you get to the late 80s, you kind of have this fascinating, crucial turning point in history, in a sense, right? You have, like, NASA and James Hansen testifying before Congress saying that this is serious, it's human caused, we have to do something about it before it's too late. You have, like, the UN IPCC founded, right, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You have the first sort of international climate negotiations taking place and the first emissions targets. I think, like, Time magazine in 1988 literally replaced Man of the Year with Planet of the Year, and their candidate was Endangered Earth. So this was an issue that everybody was thinking about, right? It's not some obscure fact. It was being brought to public attention. It was being brought to the attention of lawmakers. But what happened, right? What went wrong? Well, interesting story. There's another thing that happened around the late 80s and early 90s called neoliberalism.
Right. I was just going to say, yeah.
Exactly. Right. So that, all of this was kind of coinciding with the birth of globalization, right? So that, like, the international trade agreements that really reshaped every world economy towards deregulation and austerity. Well, you know, what was obviously needed to address the climate change crisis? Things like massive public regulation of corporations, massive investment in the public sphere, towards, like, research and development of, you know, alternative energy. Well, what does neoliberalism demand? At the same time, what was happening was the opposite, right? So with globalization, with these trade agreements, I think even in 1988, the same year that Hansen was testifying before Congress, the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement was signed into effect. And that's a whole precursor to NAFTA, to CAFTA, to everything that followed, setting up trade agreements in which it's not only difficult, but in some cases, it's literally illegal for a national government to implement public policy that would affect the bottom line and operations of for-profit transnational corporations. Under these agreements, corporations now had the ability to literally sue national governments. And that was more power than they'd ever had, at least since before the New Deal, you know, since the 1920s. So that, again, those are serious tensions. I mean, the actions that would give us the best chance of averting catastrophe and would frankly benefit the vast majority were extremely threatening to an elite minority that literally has, you know, almost total control over society, over our economy, political process, over media, changing people's minds. And in that way, it's sort of not surprising. It's sad, but it's not surprising that it unfolded that way. And that kind of really set the precedent for what we have now. We have these sort of annual UN climate summits called the Congress of Parties. They've been happening for, I don't know, 20 some odd years now. And they typically land on non-binding resolutions and market-based solutions. And it shouldn't surprise us too much that these neoliberal capitalist states are not going to, you know, render themselves powerless and go against their own interests. It's going to take a real crisis from the outside, and that's where movements come in.
It's an interesting time in society because there are so many, you know, quote-unquote woke shows like The Daily Show or John Oliver that will talk about climate change, but it's really sad. I mean, there's a really permeated nihilism within that because the punchline is always that no one cares or no one knows what to do. You know, but on the other hand, if you look at something like Standing Rock, which just touched, you know, millions of people and involved a lot of folks, and people saw it play out and saw the government repress it and saw that if it wouldn't have been for the state, if it wouldn't have been for this massive buildup of military, Blackwater police repression, that people could have obviously stopped that pipeline. So, I mean, people have an idea and a conception of what to do. It's, you know, you take action and you shut this stuff down. It's just interesting that, you know, obviously what neoliberal society feeds us over and over again is just that, you know, you can't do anything, you know, wait for Al Gore to think of a good idea, you know, turn off your lights, recycle, so on and so forth.
Well, I mean, it's certainly disheartening in some ways, and it sucks that that's the truth. But, you know, if you really look at who, at the structures of power in our current society, right, and literally what institutions own the networks that you're getting this kind of narrative from, it's not actually that surprising,
for
right?
Sure.
Yeah. You know, it's to paint the picture. I think we've reached a point where for most of society, at least for like the sort of like corporate liberals that own much of the media, it's not easy to pretend that the crisis doesn't exist at all, right? So what do? You have to kind of paint it as a sort of picture of human nature almost, right? So like, things are bad. Boy, wouldn't it be great if we could get people to care about this more.
Right.
No, we do what we can and we can kind of make individual consumer choices, but gosh gee whiz, you know, what else could be done about it? Because the alternative, right, which is that there's 100 companies that are responsible for 70 some odd percent of climate change, of global emissions, something like 25 corporations are responsible for like literally half or most. Then you have to confront those.
And the military.
You've got to take power away from them. Yeah, the military is a huge emitter. Absolutely. And that, frankly, I think is a big gap that still needs to get filled. You know, in the existing climate movement is the connection between militarism and, you know, climate chaos. But yeah, these are serious interests that control almost every institution, at least official institution in our society. And we shouldn't be surprised that they don't want to paint a picture of a world in which we could take their power away from them.
Right.
But spoiler alert, we can.
If you are just tuning in, this is the It's Going Down podcast airing on KPFA 94.1 out of Berkeley, California. It's Going Down is part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. For daily news, columns, podcasts, and more, check out itsgoingdown.org and follow us on Twitter at @IGD_news. We've been talking with a member of the Black Rose Anarchist Federation about electoral versus grassroots responses to climate change. And now, back to the show.
About a year ago, there was this big piece that was released called Losing Earth by, like, I want to say it was a New York Times journalist. And it was all about, it was like a detailed account of, you know, this history that we touched on here a little bit, about kind of the opportunities for climate legislation that were, you know, that were lost. And it, the conclusion that he came to was basically, it's just human nature. The conditions couldn't have been more ripe for change. We knew what was going on and we chose not to. And that is not just wrong. It's a dangerous kind of, narrative, a dangerous kind of sort of nihilism or resignation, because it means that it doesn't make any difference what we do. And it's pretty convenient for the powers that be to tell the story that way. And we have to be intentional about pushing back against that for sure.
So let's talk about the Green New Deal. It's a non-binding resolution. It's already been voted down. It's caused a lot of people to talk about it. It calls for a massive jobs program. And a lot of people would ask, what's so bad about it?
Well, there's a lot we can say about the Green New Deal. I mean, of course, it's no single policy or resolution, right, is going to be the solution. But actually, I think for all its limitations, something like a Green New Deal could at least play an important part of a solution. I think on the left, especially in the anarchist left, right, like it's, we're really good at kind of pointing the finger at anything that's left less than revolutionary and saying, you know, well, this is a waste of time because it's not eco-socialist utopia. But I think in the real world, it's worth engaging in if we want to achieve something, right? However limited it may be. So it's true that it's non-binding. It's true that it didn't pass, although my read, especially through even talking to people in this group, the Sunrise Movement, who kind of launched this thing, you know, it wasn't actually Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It was the Sunrise Movement, which is a sort of progressive group of young activists that really passed it off to her. It really wasn't even expected to pass in the Senate. I think it's important to see this less as like a very specific set of policies that's on the immediate table, so much as like a tactic that was used to kind of launch climate change onto the national agenda. So it has all kinds of limitations, and maybe problems with it, but that's what it is. So I think to be fair, you know, we should judge any actions, tactics, movements, groups, whatever, based on their own context and their own, you know, and sort of realistic expectations. So when it comes to Green New Deal, it's definitely less than revolutionary, but that should be expected coming from the halls of Congress. There's a sort of like net zero emissions language in there, which does leave a lot of room for things like carbon pricing that we discussed earlier, sort of like market solutions. A lot of the language is sort of vague. So things like green technologies or renewable energy is also left open to interpretation. That could include, like, who knows, right? Like crazy geoengineering projects or nuclear power. That's worth paying attention to and being concerned about. It also mentions a sort of goal of launching the U.S., into the global sphere as a sort of quote unquote world leader in green technology, which is sort of like dangerously, at least implicit, imperialism. But the fact that it's so open and vague and just got launched out there can also be taken as an opportunity, I think. Like I said, it's really, I think what it set out to do more than anything else is to launch climate change and something like a Green New Deal onto the national agenda. And to be frank, it sort of achieved that, right? Like you said, John Oliver is running a show on this thing, and however limited and reformist or liberal it may be to, you know, us radicals or self-professed revolutionaries, I think that's an undeniably positive development that deserves some credit. I think that we need to be critical about it like we're critical about anything else to understand its limitations and to understand how we navigate this movement and push things where we think they need to go. So, in some ways, the more interesting question that's been largely left out of the conversation is the question of how. Like, while everybody debates the merits of this specific proposal, there's sort of an implicit assumption that all that's needed is to make these policies, you know, all that's needed to make these policies reality is to sort of get enough people to agree that it's a good idea and maybe for us to have progressive politicians in office, right? And there's a real potential dead-end street, right? It may feel like a shortcut, but, you know, the whole process, when framed in that way, and I think more or less this is one of the problems or at least limitations of Sunrise's approach, is that everything is sort of reduced to this question of like political will rather than power, right? So, if we can just garner the political will, if we can create a spectacle and get the right hashtag and get a well-drafted resolution that sort of doesn't offend anybody but checks all the right boxes, then we're going to win it, right? And that is not how the world works. I think that is the kind of dangerous fantasy because it really surrenders the power of movements and kind of sets us up for failure? And I think that that's really important question. And I don't hear it discussed as much as people kind of, you know, going through this 14-page resolution and saying, well, you know, here's my problem with this or with that. That's fine. But the real question is like whether or not this resolution is the resolution, what would it take to actually get large scale, you know, fundamental policy changes on the scale of something like the New Deal? And it ain't from electoral politics and ain't about political will, right? It's about power. And that's that crucial question. That's where the New Deal is actually not a bad analogy. You know, I mean, it's a pretty good analogy because as flawed as the Green New Deal may be or as limited, I mean, heck, the New Deal was extremely limited and extremely flawed. It even had explicit racial and gender biases written into it. But nonetheless, it was pretty far reaching. It challenged the most powerful interests in the country.
And overall, the New Deal, I would argue, was a way to save capitalism. Or, you know, just like the name implies, you know, it's a new deal. It's a new social contract. It's a new attempt at social peace. Just like I think the Green New Deal is, it's a way to try to save capitalism from itself in the face of climate catastrophe. It's not some sort of massive redistribution of wealth or dismantling of power relations within society. It's anything but. It's a way to reorganize capitalism in a way that keeps it running. It's a lot like UBI or any of these different schemes.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. It's a mess. But I think there's nothing really new about the fact that the priority of nation states is to kind of hold on to what they got and to maintain their own power.
For sure.
And the class interests within those nation states, right? That's what they're set up to do. So I don't know that anything's just fundamentally different. It's true that the climate crisis presents a sort of unique kind of crisis in that it's on a time crunch, which is not insignificant. But still, the New Deal is not a bad analogy. Like you said, in some ways, what was limited about the New Deal, the original New Deal, was that it was set up to sort of preserve and protect capitalism itself. But the crucial question there, right, is what was threatening capitalism itself? And that was us. That right. was the masses. That was the people. The story that we're told about the New Deal, right, is that, you know, it's something like, you know, there's this guy FDR and he just really genuinely cared about the plight of the poor. He's a sensible guy and, you know, he had the vision to understand that what was best for the country was, you know, to protect workers' rights and create, you know, social safety net and jobs program and all this stuff. But that's fantasy again. That's getting back to fantasy. You know, what really happened was there was a full on political crisis. Like you said, they had to preserve the existence of the current power structures. So you had, I mean, in 1934 alone, I think there was something like 2,000 strikes around the country, mass wave of strikes, including a lot of sit down strikes. Those are like basically occupations of factories by their workers. You had general strikes in places like San Francisco, entire West Coast ports shut down. You had unemployment councils set up in revolt. You had veterans converging on the Capitol by the thousands and demanding early payment of pensions. You had populist farmer revolts where farmers were literally destroying crops and milk to affect the commodity prices and getting into pitched battles with police and the military. This was a full-on political crisis, and the establishment was faced with a decision. And that decision is either bend or break. And they chose bend, and they usually will, right? And that's exactly the kind of crisis that we're going to need to be able to create. So we're going to need to be able to build powerful movements on a mass scale that can threaten the very existence of the current power structures. And without doing that, we're going to come up short, I think. And there's some serious missing pieces that make the context now different from, you know, the kind of the weapons that we had at our disposal in the 30s. One of them is a militant mass labor movement.
There's a new wave of climate activists that are coming onto the streets right now. There's groups like Climate Rebellion, Climate Strike. What do we make of these groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should kind of approach these groups and developments just like any other. I mean, especially in light of the crisis that we're discussing, I tend to err on the side of trying to be positive, or at least acknowledge the positive developments represented in these kinds of formations, like Climate Strike and Extinction Rebellion and things like this. I mean, in light of the severity of the crisis, if somebody's going to come along and try to bring more people into the movement and get people into the streets and you know, airing their you know, concerns about the crisis and demanding fundamental change, then who am I to poo-poo that, you know? I mean, that's kind of just at the surface level. So I think a lot of this, though, comes down to just expectations and context, right? So, like, again, going back to kind of, I don't know, this culture of left purity, it's pretty easy to stand back as a sort of self-described revolutionary and say, oh, well, you know, this is just a bunch of liberals, you know, trying to kind of play around with the edges of capitalism. And, you know, they're just doing symbolic protests anyway. But really, I think we should take them in their context. And I kind of see them, especially things like Extinction Rebellion and Climate Strike, as sort of like something like Occupy for the climate, right? So it's like, it's the kind of thing that happens when a group of young people, sort of become newly politicized, maybe, and inspired to take action. And they find creative ways to sort of, in their mind, try to get the attention of those in power with the hopes that maybe they'll change their minds and inspire different policy, right? In this case, like a policy which reflects the reality of the climate crisis. I think in the case of Extinction Rebellion and I guess in Climate Strike as well, they sort of have happened to light a spark of sorts, and they brought a whole lot of new people into the movement, and I commend them for that. I think that's great. One of their strengths, I think, has just been their accessibility, right? So, like, if you're a group of students, or if you're willing to, like, join a street protest or, like, block an intersection, or not show up to school one day, like, you have an on-ramp. And so that's a strength, but there's also, you know, serious limitations, right? So, like, these groups are largely sort of focused on creating spectacle, I think. Kind of appealing to the conscience of those in power. And I think that is a real limitation that has to be overcome.
It is interesting. A lot of these groups in their names, you know, strike, action, they really kind of bring to mind, you know, like the freeway blockades of Black Lives Matter, the occupations of the student movement, or the occupation of squares from Occupy, all these things. But really, when you look at the actions that they're doing, like you said, they're very symbolic, they're largely spectacles, and they're aimed at basically getting the attention of politicians and then trying to get them to do some sort of legislation. They're not really about people directly either blockading or shutting down the economy or putting another form of life into place. I just hope that young people that are getting involved in these movements, they make that break, you know, while they're engaging and organizing. I hope they stick around as long. The only other real big critique I have is just the way in which we see kind of the logic of social media kind of playing out, like the way that people within these movements that have, you know, X amount of followers kind of become the de facto leaders or these kind of figureheads just because they have so much following on social media, which is really something that's new. I mean, we're looking at a new kind of form of protest movement that's really informed and created and comes out of social media.
Yeah, I think it's complicated, right? Like, there's no, something like Extinction Rebellion is not a monolith, right? It's all kinds
For
of
sure.
things, and there's all kinds of tendencies within it. And it's also not something that's static, right? Like, any kind of movement formation like that is always fluid and changeable and constantly changing. And so a lot of what these movements do depends on kind of how people choose to participate in them. I mean, some, whether or not it's worth the time or it's strategic to participate in a, as like a radical in a given action or group, right, is just, there's no one size fits all answer, obviously, to something like that. It's all about the context and the goals and expectations. But yeah, you know, things like if these kinds of movements are taking energy away from important actions, like you mentioned against pipelines or something like that, and they're divorced from existing kind of like struggles on the ground, or they're kind of rendering language like strike and rebellion and direct action sort of hollow, then that's a problem. But I think for the most part, what they're doing is bringing in more people. And it's just, it's messy because movements are messy, man. And I think, what's most important, like for anybody that considers themselves, to me, for anybody that considers themselves a radical or a revolutionary or a militant or whatever you want to call it, is to jump in and get your hands dirty. You know, again, who knows in a specific context whether or not it's a good idea, but it's not a question of purity. It's a question of strategy, right? So, while they may be kind of like using radical language in a sort of half-assed way, and a lot of them may be liberals or whatever, I think more than anything else, their impact is to bring more people in to the movement. And they're going to run up against limits within that model, but at least they're being brought in. And they have even made some, in the case of Extinction Rebellion in the UK, you know, as symbolic as it may be, within a week of these mass actions in which I think 1,000 people in the UK were arrested in a single week or something like that, the parliament declared like the first ever national emergency around climate change. And that's, again, it's a sort of a symbolic gesture, but it's not insignificant. You know, it shows that they were having an impact. And for those of us who see serious limits or issues in there, I would urge us, you know, if we take ourselves seriously and are interested in achieving things, I would just urge us to jump in and to do what we can to push things in a more militant direction, a more democratic direction, a more independent direction from sort of institutional channels of activism. And that's just kind of always the role of revolutionaries, I think, is to push movements as much as possible to up against the limits of the prevailing system with the sort of analysis and the historical context and the confidence that there is another world that's possible on the other side, and that this existing system does have limits, so let's find them.
What are some struggles that are happening around the world that you're following against resource extraction, climate change, and fossil fuels that are really inspiring you right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of inspiring organizing that's always happening, right? And a lot of it we probably never even hear about, you know, local struggles, especially local indigenous struggles in places like South America we often don't hear anything about. But they're happening. They've been happening for years. People face consequences way more extreme than we do often in North America with, you know, government-sponsored paramilitary groups and, you know, lead organizers just disappearing in the night. So there's all kinds of inspiring organizing that's constantly happening. The work in Germany that you mentioned, the Indigolanda movement against massive sort of strip mining for coal, I think is really inspiring. For those who haven't heard about it, look it up. I recently met with one of the members of that group when they were on that speaking tour that you mentioned. And it is just inspiring seeing images and hearing stories of just literally thousands of people. I think in some cases, like 10,000 or more people converging en masse on this single piece of infrastructure and just completely shutting it down to the extent that the cops just couldn't do anything about it just out of sheer numbers. And that, I think, is a real taste of what we're going to need on a mass scale kind of everywhere if we're really going to win what we need to win in time. So those are inspiring examples. You know, they've won some concessions. I think the government there, as a result of those actions, conceded to like a phase out of coal that's way too long, something like 20 years. But they are having an effect, and the campaign continues, obviously. But there's also a lot of good examples close to home. I mean, Standing Rock, I think, is just undeniable as a kind of, in some ways, a shining light of a kind of mass action and mass power that is possible and necessary. Unfortunately, like we talked about earlier, due to the change in political context, that fight was sort of lost in a way. But there's lessons to be learned there too. I think in some ways it's just due to the fact that Standing Rock wasn't popping off until it was just a little bit too late. Things were already being constructed and we need kind of to go on the offensive, I would say, like with a Standing Rock everywhere. A key piece of that is just the fact that it was rooted in mass direct action and occupation, that it was led by a community, in this case, an indigenous community, asserting its own right to self-determination and really defending itself from a colonialist assault, which was this pipeline. And that's going to look different everywhere. But the basic framework of sustained and escalating mass action on that scale, whether Standing Rock or Endigalanda or anything else, is the direction we need to be going in. And I think in some ways we also need to look into history. You know, we talked about the New Deal. There's important lessons there. It's not just about looking elsewhere in place, but elsewhere in time, to learn important lessons about what gives movements their power and what does it really take to threaten, literally threaten the existence of prevailing power structures. And I think that the biggest lesson learned there, as relates to the New Deal and relating it to today, to the Green New Deal, is about just a militant class struggle. I mean, more than ever, I think this comes to especially a central point in Black Rose's analysis, is that now more than ever, we need to up the class struggle, not just in this like traditional conception of this like white male Western factory worker, but literally a holistic class struggle that is multiracial, that is anti-colonial, that is inherently feminist and inherently ecological. Without that, we're missing pretty important tools in our tool belt. If we want to actually threaten those power structures, and we've got a long way to go. Obviously, the labor movement, specifically in the United States, has been beaten down and beaten down for decades now. The parts of it that still exist are largely bureaucratic and even reactionary. But the only way to build that back up is through rank and file grassroots organizing. That's the only way it's ever happened, I think. And there's really no shortcut. I think there's a lot of people that will say, like, you know, we don't have time for that. We don't have time to build power and to organize in our workplaces and our communities. And it's often used as a sort of justification for this kind of spectacle approach to organizing. But I would push back. I would say the opposite is true. I would say specifically because we are in a crisis, that is why we cannot afford to waste our time with dead end strategies. And, you know, that's why we need to do real organizing and build real power. Because if we don't, we're going to fall short. And when things start getting bad, we're not going to be organized as a counterforce to the forces of reaction. And that could get ugly quick. So the same kind of power that we need to build to beat things back, as far as the fossil fuel industry, is the same kind of power that we need to kind of build new structures that are directly democratic.
Yeah, I think another major task is just drawing the anti-capitalist line in the sand in all these struggles. I mean, obviously, the massive amounts of expenditures of fossil fuels is tied into the growth of GDP, tied into the need for capitalism to always grow. And, you know, that growth is distinctly tied to, you know, fossil fuel emissions, tied to climate change. And we're not going to be able to deal with any of those problems unless we deal with capitalism.
It's funny, you know, that I obviously agree that capitalism is more or less a root cause of this crisis. At the same time, sometimes the way that fact is sort of, I don't know, communicated publicly can almost be disempowering, right? Especially if people don't feel like they can grasp what concrete steps can I take towards building a different kind of society. This idea that capitalism is inherently destroying Earth can easily feel sort of like inevitable, right? Well, oh my God, well, capitalism is just like the way things are, right? So I think it's important to help show people that there are ways, there are steps that you can take. And also, we obviously can't just wait around until capitalism has been completely abolished to address the crisis. It's more a matter of degree. So we need to get organized to push things as far as we can towards something like democratic and worker control, towards pushing back against any sort of commodification and profiteering of natural resources, to defend community self-determination over what happens, in a particular place and what affects a particular set of people. And that's just going to look different wherever it happens, but it's going to have to look like masses of people organizing where they work and where they live to kind of take power back from these concentrated capitalist hands and state hands, into the hands of the communities, into the hands of workers and students. And that, again, that's just gonna look different, wherever it happens. But, that doesn't mean that we can't get started. I think, I don't know, one thing that we haven't touched on yet, we could talk about this all for days, but I think is important is linking this climate movement to, for one, linking it to internationalism and struggles against militarism. I mean, it's kind of crazy to talk about climate change, ignoring the fact that the Trump administration, as we speak, is threatening war with Iran, right? And the U.S. military is one of the largest emitters of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet, if not the most. And so we're going to need to make connections through all these different facets of society, not just around militarism, but around colonialism as well, right? Like here in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of the fights around like pipeline resistance and resistance against fossil fuel expansion projects at the local level are centered around indigenous-led struggles for self-determination. And so that's another way that we need to make these connections, but it looks different in every community. So somebody that's listening to this, that's wondering, okay, I get it. Everything's bad. We're on a course for crisis. Capitalism is the problem, but what the heck do I do about it? There's no one size fits all, but I'd say you gotta kind of look around in your own immediate community. Look at where you work, where you live, where you study, where you play, where you pray. How is this place connected to the broader crisis, connected to the institutions of capitalism, the institutions of the fossil fuel industry? And where are those pressure points of power? How could you get organized where you live and where you work, to push back, to build a counterpower in that context? And that's really what it's all about. That's really the definition of what popular power means. And that's what we're pushing for in Black Rose.
You've been listening to the It's Going Down podcast on KPFA 94.1 FM out of Berkeley, California. We've been talking to a member of the Black Rose Anarchist Federation about grassroots anti-capitalist responses to climate change and building popular power. To learn more about Black Rose, go to blackrosefed.org. It's Going Down is a digital community center for anarchists, anti-fascists, autonomous anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide a resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action. Visit us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at @IGD_news. Thanks for listening and to hip-hop artist Soul for the music, and we will see you soon.